Since the previous talk was a nice introduction to some of the ideas that I will present in the direct approach. My talk will focus on measurement of inter-client compliance by MR. We are trying to focus on, if you will, clinical translation work. We want to measure a parameter that may have some diagnostic test. And so this presentation will focus about inter-client compliance, modeling versus direct approach. I want to acknowledge, I really was very fortunate to have very good students during the last 10 years that I've been working on that, and really they deserve all the credit. I'm very fortunate we're now beginning to get NIH support, and more recently we're getting support from the Washington Square Health Foundation to extend the work that we are doing to children, and I'm working with Dr. Tomita from Children Memorial. So background, inter-client compliance, it's important that we really understand what we're talking about. Generally it's a good advice. Determines the ability of the inter-client compartment to accommodate increasing volume. And there are many mechanisms that cause increasing volume, for example edema, without a large increase in pressure. Inter-client compartments characterize the biomechanical state of the craniospinal system. And we don't have one compliance, we can move from one state to a different state. It has been suggested that inter-client compliance has an important role in the pathophysiology of neurosurgical problems such as, is Dr. Marmor here? I have a few slides specifically for him, but such as the work that he has shown in TBI, hydrocephalus, and chiari malformation. So non-invasive of inter-canal compliance would have a considerable diagnostic value. So I will start with focus on the modeling approach, and I will very briefly touch on generic models and patient-specific derived models. Generic models is, for example, you construct a model and you assume some hypothetical values to different components of your models. And I want to really acknowledge the work by Agarwal that was done in 1969. He was the first one to do a lump parameter model of the CSF system, and he was developing the first generic mathematical model of the interaction between the intracranial blood flow and the hydrodynamics. He really understood that you cannot talk about hydrodynamics independently on blood flow. It's interesting, I moved to University of Illinois at Chicago, and I moved to the University of Illinois at Chicago, and I didn't know about him for 5 years. And then one of my students found this paper, and we invited him to join our lab meetings, and he didn't have any idea how much progress, how important this work that he's initiated. So I really want to dedicate this presentation to him. He recently retired from the University of Chicago, of Illinois. So this model accounted for CSF formation and absorption. It did not account for cranial or spinal compartment, but amazingly, or not so amazingly, it was able to explain the increased CSF pulsation in mass lesion. 8 years later, Ursino et al. Presented a simple mathematical model of the interaction between ICP and serial hemodynamic. Basically, they extended this work and they accounted for inter-client compliance. And here you see the much more detailed approach that they provided. But what's the limitation of generic? We have to remember the limitation of generic models. It's not patient-specific. It utilizes a lot of hypothetical values. A lot of simplifications is done, simplify complex nonlinear transition between the state by fixing many of these parameters. But I still think that there is some usefulness to this work because it may explain observed phenomena or rule out wrong explanation. The second approach is not to come up with a generic model, but to measure data from a specific patient and to see what does this data, can this data suggest what is the system that we are looking into. And I will talk about models that we can generate based on volumetric flow measurements, and I think when the term of volume accounting is really important, so we are really focusing on volumetric flow measurements. Also, we have been, it was important to separate the CSF flow dynamic to two components that are occurring on two different time scale. The bulk flow, which is basically the net movement from the formation site to the absorption site, and the pulsatility of the CSF, the back and flow motion that occur on the scale of the millisecond compared of minute. So we can really separate those two scales and focus on the pulsatility. And here is our volume accounting approach that we have been doing since 1996. So we are looking at the craniospinal system from a compartment point of view, that we have a cranial compartment that is nearly rigid. It's not totally rigid, it has a finite small compliance, and then the spinal canals that is more compliant. And then we have inflow, arterial inflow, venous outflow, and bidirectional CSF flowing in and out. It's important to understand or to remember that under the physiological terms, brain, blood, and CSF are incompressible. So from a volume accounting approach, the change in intracranial volume is the driving force for the CSF pulsation from the cranium to spinal canal. This is our view of the system. So here is our system, our compartment model with the inlets and outlets, and here is the MRI measurement of volumetric flow rate, which I will later explain. But if you look at this, if you look at the input and outputs, we can basically measure how many cows or how much volume of fluid is going into the compartment in each instant during the cardiac cycle. So we have the total arterial inflow of one cardiac cycle, the venous outflow, and the CSF flow. Another way to look at this information is to look at the net blood flow at each instant to subtract what's going out than what's going in, and we have what we call the A minus V waveform, and we plot the CSF again. We don't do any scaling, and this is flow in milliliter per minute. And I think this is very instructive to really show that the CSF pulsation at the level between the cranium and spinal canal is really driven by the difference between arterial and venous. So we wanted to look at this from a system point of view and said, let's see what we can learn about the cranium by looking at the A minus V as a deriving force and the CSF as outflow, as output. So we can derive the transfer function and get the electrical circuit analogy. Here is our output, here is A minus V input of the function of time, and that's the impulse response on the step response. And we have done that, and for example, we here in black, we got a curve that look very good approximation to monoexponential curve. If you have an electrical circuit, an RC circuit, the monoexponential response function will indicate that the system behaves as an RC. So basically, we can say that from the measurement itself, we can characterize one exponential curve, unfortunately, only by one parameter. And we can say that this tau is proportional to resistance to CSF flow between the cranial spine canal and the intracranial compliance. And we had the opportunity to study patient before and after skull defect correction, and our assumption was that when you remove the skull, but the dura is intact, intracranial compliance is larger, can accommodate much larger volume without increasing pressure. And indeed, if we fitted our model, our measurements to a monoexponential model, we got tau that is about 2.5 times in the open skull compared to the closed skull. And in this case, we could assume that the resistance doesn't change. So it was quite, if you will, promising that this approach can give you a hint on the compliance. But look, by the fact that we are simplifying the system and trying to fit this curve into a monoexponential curve, we are giving up some information. Then we tried to add inertia and few more to get a better curve fit, and we could get it, but it didn't advance us, because we are getting basically a curve fit and a more parameters that we can derive, but it doesn't lead you to the ability to isolate compliance. And if you are interested more in this early work that we have done, it was published in Magnetic Granules in Medicine in 1996. So then we looked at, is it possible to go about direct approach into this, into measuring intercom compliance. And indeed, Marmor works from 1975 measured compliance. He was the first one to measure compliance by directly measuring volume and pressure change. Here we see a recording of pressure, and at this point in time, he's injecting volume. He knows how much volume he inject. And there is a pressure change, and since it's an invasive technique, it can measure the pressure change and know the volume and can get compliance. From this important measurement that Marmor did, you also find the importance that the elastance, that the relationship between intercom pressure and volume is mono-exponential. Basically, what it means is that the compliance, the ability to accommodate volume, is much larger at low pressure, and it's much smaller at high pressure. Elastance is the inverse of compliance. So, if we can measure this volume and pressure changes that occur naturally in every cardiac cycle, and here you see this small, every cardiac cycle, there is a bolus of blood going into the brain that causes pulse pressure. Instead of us invasively injecting volume from outside, if we can measure this small volume change and those pressure change, we will be able to measure compliance directly. And this is how we measure intercom compliance with MR. So just to quickly review the principles. Pulsatile blood flow to the brain causes changes in the intracranial volume during cardiac cycle. The volume causes change in pressure. The ratio of pressure and volume pressure is the compliance. And I will now talk, the second part of my presentation is how we measure DV and DP from MRI. As the previous speaker said, that if we do some volume accounting, and this is our swimming pool or our cranium, if we know at each instant how much going in and how much going out, we know if there is more carbs or more water in our swimming pools. And we are not restricting the sensors to be fixed. So we are allowing the sensors to move a little bit, but we know that they are closed and they will not go out. So we are accounting for this volume. And I think I can go faster here because Mark told us about this beautiful MR technique that can measure velocities as a function of time. In our swimming pool, the inlet is the internal carotid artery and the tubal artery. The outlet is the jugular veins and other veins that we account for. And here I'm showing a three-dimensional plot of the velocity values as a function of time. This is our arterial pulsation, and we see that the venous pulsation as well. Okay. It's very important if we want to get volumetric flow rate to identify the lumen, the boundary of this tube, very accurately. We have tried to use techniques that were available in the literature, and we found that they're not reliable. And we developed techniques that basically use, instead of one image, the velocity signature of each voxel to decide if the pixel is inside the lumen or outside the lumen. And this technique, when we compared it to phantom, showed that it's really increased considerably the precision and accuracy of volumetric flow measurements. So here is our inputs, arterial input, venous output.
What are the errors?
Excuse me?
What do the error flags look like on that?
The error on this one?
Error flags.
Error flags.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to...
The error flags for volumetric flow rate, if you do right, there is work that done, I forgot the name, I see by the group in Toronto, by a Brian Roth group, actually it's in London, Ontario, sorry for people who are not from Toronto, not far from here. Phase contrast technique has been very well scrutinized, it's within 3%. So it's a very accurate method that is inherent accuracy in this technique. As we remember, our swimming pool has three inlets and outlets, and one of them is a CSF. The velocity of the CSF are much smaller, and here is the, sorry, here is the outlet for the CSF at that level, just below foramen magnum, and we see the CSF bidirectional flow, and we can even see a small epidural vein that is going in one direction here. And here we can get the volumetric flow rate over one cardiac cycle. So at this point in time, we accounted for all the volumes that are entering and exiting our intracranial compartment, arterial flow, venous flow, and CSF. And if we subtract at each instant, we get this net transcranial volume. This is our bolus that the heart is responsible for compared to the invasive bolus, which is analogous of Dr. Mamro pressure volume curve. And the only thing that we need to integrate in time to show what is the reference volume during one cardiac cycle. So this is a volume change that Dr. Kuan talked about before during one cardiac cycle. We had some problem initially to convey this message to neurosurgeon or clinicians, because they are used to the fact that Kelly-Monroe doctrine stated the volume is fixed. And indeed, we are using the constraint that on average, in steady state, the volume is fixed, but we are allowing fluctuation within one cardiac cycle. So we do this simulation to show that at each instant, what's entering and what's going out doesn't equal zero. So we have this intracranial volume change during the cardiac cycle, and it's of the order of a fraction of cc. And I think it gives you a sense of how tight this compartment is. A less of 1 cc when given is responsible for the pulse pressure of 3-4 millimeter mercury that we normally see. So no wonder if we have bleeding of volumes that are bigger than milliliter. Yes, so go ahead, sir. We are recently, my hospitals and collaborating hospitals is not a, we don't see pediatric population, but very recently we started collaboration with Dr. Tomita, and we have measurements of from 4 weeks to 16. I don't have the number right now, but I will get back to you. But so the question is, how reliable are these intracranial volume measurements? The volume of the cranium is about a liter and a half, and we are talking about something that we need to measure reliable in a fraction of a percentage. The reason, by the way, I think if Dr. Inman can measure microns with this technique, you said you can measure tens of microns, it's because of the properties that MR is very sensitive tool to measure phase. And what we are measuring here is phase. So there was no other gold standard that we could compare our technique. So we take advantage of our clinical collaborations that allow us to study the patients before and after skull defect. And we see that with such a large portion of the skull missing, though the dura is intact, we have a larger volume change compared to what happened after the skull closure. And this trend was consistent in all the three patients that we studied. We resorted to phantom studies to make sure that we can really determine the inherent accuracy of the MRI technique to measure this volume change in a system that we know under controlled condition what is the volume change, and we verified that we can do that reliably. So the second component, I hope I convinced you. No, this is intracranial volume change. This has nothing to do with the spinal compartment. Where it is? Oh, yes, please. I will answer your question. Yeah. Exactly. I got.
Variation in time, there's some variation between patients. time, but what was cost of the reason why such a good idea, and I was extremely, it didn't gain very strong. And as you know, I have measured such a good idea for many years, and one argument from quite police again that they didn't or no use for measuring it, because it is being because the kind of volume change equals all that. And it's known that arterial blood pressure effect is a kind of volume change. So my question is, given that the normal intracranial pulse amplitude is about 3 millimeters,
yeah.
And taking into account this variation in
just one second. You're talking inter-individual variation? Because you're right, we found that the range just between healthy individuals is rather large.
Concerning.
The amplitude of the volume change.
Yes.
That's, I agree with that.
So then my question is, given about 3 millimeters of mercury, of course there is a difference about that.
Yeah.
How much would the difference in amplitude be given the maximum difference in intracranial volume change of
that? It's a function of compliance. That's exactly what the compliance will determine.
But in a normal situation.
What? I didn't understand the question. In normal situation, for example, you can do the calculation. You said it's about 3 millimeter mercury normal ICP pulse pressure, and you're talking about a 0.5 millimeter volume, milliliter, to about 1.2.
The volume change is about 1 millimeter.
The what? Yes.
It's about 1 millimeter.
It's,
I suppose that the difference among individuals is not 10 millimeters.
No, I'm saying that this value, this curve, is for one individual.
Yes. But another individual probably do not have a change of 5 millimeters.
Right. I think that the range. Absolutely. Absolutely.
My question is, given this maximum range,
right,
how different
would
the amplitude be?
But it depends. The amplitude, as the definition of this ratio of volume change and pressure change, is a function of compliance. And the compliance is different between upright and spine and supine, for example. So it's hard to say that there will be pulse pressure that is will be directly proportional to the volume change, because the compliance will determine what is specifically this ratio.
Certainly, I'm talking about a normal situation.
Yeah.
What is supposed to be a normal situation? Of course,
yeah.
The normal range of
volume change? That's what I'm telling you. In the 20 subjects that we have studied, the smallest one was about 0.4 and the largest one was about 1.6. I say, I didn't understand. I said I mentioned it. Okay. No. Okay. Sorry about this. So, the pressure change. There was another question here. Ah, yes. NASA has been, that's a good question. NASA has been trying to measure intracranial pressure by measuring very accurately the distance between the temporal bones. And they show that there is a minute changes. So we cannot consider the skull, even my phantom that is made out of a solid, there were places there was a give. So there is a give, but I think that it's a combination of the tiny motion of some region in the skull, as well as places where the dura has a give around foramina and so forth. So
the motion of the skull.
Excuse me?
How much would the skull have to know the art to account for one role?
You can ask. It's a fraction of. It's a very small. You can take a sphere of a liter and a half and make a.
Wouldn't it more likely say be the exitoram and maybe the lamina?
That's what that's exactly what I said. I said it's a combination.
Yeah. Exiting,
but no, cranial nerve is not in the cranial compartment. You're talking about the cranial nerve, not in the spinal canal? Okay, sorry. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
The point of this is, that's the compliance you measure.
The brain has no compliance if we agree that it is incompressible. We are measuring the compliance of the box.
Okay, good. And the box is expandable.
The box, which is the confinement of the dura, has a give. It's not much. That's why the pulsations are so high for such a small volume change. Let me go very quickly. How do we measure the pressure difference? The pressure difference we measure using the Navier-Stokes equation that relate derivatives of velocities to pressure change. It will go faster. Here's pressure change waveform. We repeated this measurement several times to see what is the reproducibility of the peak-to-peak measurements. Again, because MRI is such a nice technique, it's a very reasonable variability. But we are interested in the pulse pressure, not pulse pressure gradient. So we had initially resorted to invasive measurements in baboon, and our mechanical engineers told us that fluid dynamics is a scale dependent, so we resort to a large non-human primate, and we saw that in this primate, for example, there was a direct relationship between the pulse pressure and the pulse pressure gradient. We manipulated the pressure to be on different points along the pressure. Our collaborators from the mechanical engineering told us that they can do this simulation to look at this relationship and save us from doing a large number of baboons. And here is a comparison just to give you the visual correspondence between low pulse pressure and low pulse pressure gradient and high pulse pressure gradient. Just want to show you this graph is that we measure elastance, which is the inverse of compliance, and we found in patients that we measure ICP simultaneously in the MR, we get very excellent linear correlation between absolute pressure and elastance index. And when we use this correlation to translate from elastance to ICP, we can get absolute measure of ICP, and here is distribution of invasive measurements, and here is distribution in non-invasive MRI in large number of measurements, and we get very similar distribution of ranges. So this is the way we are indirectly validating compliance measurements. I was hoping that Dr. Mano is here, and it's important to point out that the pressure volume response test and the MRI intracranial compliance have differences that would explain differences in the measurements. And I think physicists would probably be able to appreciate the importance of these differences when you do measurements. The duration of the both of this intervention is several seconds, while it's on the order of a few tenths of a millisecond in the natural occurrence. So this is a much more accurate perturbation of the system compared to this. And of course, the amount that we interfere with the system is much smaller. So we are not changing the biomechanical state of the system. And finally, one needs to remember that the invasive technique sample both the intracranial and the spinal canal. And my belief is the larger differences are in the compliance of the spinal canal, inter-individual differences, and our technique only measure the direct intracranial compliance and not intracranial spinal compliance. How much time I have? Okay. I would change my presentation because I was very happy to learn in the last few days that people have independently and successfully implemented the MRICP method and applied it to important clinical application. They measured non-invasive MRI assessment of intracranial compliance in idiopathic normal pressure hydrocephalus. And I will go over, I really want to acknowledge this is not our work. This is work by another group that is just recently have published this. Intracranial compliance was determined in 7 normal pressure hydrocephalus, in 6 brain atrophy, and in 11 control group. And then they did a TAP test on 2 patients. And here is the results. It has been suggested by invasive technique that low compliance is associated with normal pressure hydrocephalus, And I just came from San Francisco where we had the ICP 2007 meeting, and somebody showed that compliance is a better predictor for shunt responders than other techniques that he is compared to. So we see here the much lower compliance in his normal pressure hydrocephalus patient compared to the control and vascular dementia group. And furthermore, when you did the TAP test, where you restore CSF, you expect your compliance to increase, and this is a change in the increase of intracranial compliance for the two patients that you follow up.
You don't mean there's an error flag?
Excuse me?
Those error flags covering everything? I mean, you look at them, they're all overlapping groups, right? So for an individual patient, that might not be a good test, but for a group of patients...
No, I think this is a statistical significance between...
No, between the vascular dementia one. The group we'd
like to
get rid of, and just shut the people.
Okay. I didn't do the test, but I think it's a good start. It's very promising. I'm sure that they will improve the measurement technique and things technique, but this is the first confirmation of non-invasive measurements to what we know from invasive measurements. And finally, I want to thank you and...
Could we perhaps take a moment now? So just have a...